Mrs. Mary Darling slept by the fire. Putting the children to sleep had utterly exhausted her. She didn't even have the energy to leave the nursery. Michael and John had begged for a story. She had dutifully stayed awake while Wendy, the eldest of the three, told them a story about Neverland. Mary had smiled fondly at this. Neverland was a place unique to a child's imagination, different for each one. John's was a lagoon with flamingos flying over it, while his younger brother's was full of kites. In Wendy's Neverland, she lived in a house made of leaves and cared for a pet wolf left behind by his parents. As Mary slept, she had a curious dream. She saw Neverland from afar, an island nestled in shimmering seas. She felt something straining against the edges of her dream, as if attempting to break the barrier between this imaginary world and the real one. She awakened to a strange shadow on the ceiling above her. It looked like a young boy. She lowered her gaze to find this boy hovering at eye level, staring at her. She leapt to her feet. The boy snarled at her and flew toward the window. The covers on the children's beds stirred as he passed, but somehow they remained fast asleep. Nana, a massive Newfoundland, bounded through the door, having sensed the intruder as well. Running after the boy, she leapt toward the window and slammed it shut behind him with her paws. The dog dutifully made the rounds to check that the children were asleep, nuzzling each one in turn. Satisfied, she went and sat by the door, mouth open in a satisfied smile. Mary steadied herself, saying over and over again that she imagined the whole thing. As she left the room, she cast one last glance toward the window and stopped. Something was caught in the frame. It looked like a piece of black fabric. It was the boy's shadow. I'm Vanessa Richardson. You're listening to Tales. Today we're continuing the story of Peter Pan, following his first encounter with Wendy Darling and her brothers, and how he took them to Neverland. The tales on this podcast are dark, sometimes scary, and full of adult themes. Peter Pan is still the childlike hero we met in part one, but adopts a more violent edge in this version of the tale. This story involves swashbuckling, violent jealousy, and several cases of attempted child murder. Additionally, Barry's original story contains some offensive language and stereotyping of the Native American people, which we have done our best to eliminate in this adaptation. Please exercise caution for children under 13. If you want to hear more tales, you can find all of Parcast's podcasts wherever you listen to podcasts. Many of you have asked how you can help the show. If you enjoy Tales, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen. All children, except one, grow up. These famous words begin nearly every retelling of J.M. Barrie's iconic story, Peter Pan. After conceiving the character in his 1902 novel, The Little White Bird, Barrie was ready to give the character his own full story with the 1904 play, Peter Pan or the Boy Who Would Never Grow Up. In this chapter, Barrie introduces the most critical flaw in his beloved hero, his childlike memory. A boy who always lives in the moment, Peter Pan slips into forgetfulness regularly, sometimes forgetting the names of people he considers close friends. This is a chilling reminder that, like a child, Peter's pleasures are fleeting and forgotten when they can no longer provide amusement. As we will see in the coming story, this tendency is of particular frustration to Wendy Darling, the young girl who falls in love with Peter Pan. Her love is doomed to go unrequited forever. Peter just doesn't possess the depth of feeling for it. The night lights burned gently beside each child's bed. Wendy watched the flickering orange patterns play across the ceiling as they grew dimmer and dimmer. Even as the last of the lights winked out, she could not sleep. It wasn't her brother's snoring that kept her awake, or even Nana patrolling up and down the hall. It was a haunting thought from the evening before that troubled her. Her parents had brought some guests over for dinner, and one of her mother's friends remarked on how grown up Wendy looked. This shouldn't have disturbed her, but it kept echoing through her mind like an unwanted draft in the bedroom. She was quite content with her current age. She blinked. The nightlights had been relit. No, this light was a brighter yellow, flickering against the ceiling. Then a bright speck of light flew past her face. Startled, Wendy pulled her covers up to her nose. Her eyes followed that strange speck as it zipped and dove around the room. It was almost like someone had set a horsefly on fire and let it loose. She noticed another sound in the room. It sounded like sobbing, coming from the foot of her bed. She raised herself onto her elbows and peered down. By her bed was a boy. He was dressed in a garment of leaves and vines, and through his slightly parted lips, she could see he still had his baby teeth. In one hand, he held a bar of soap. In the other, he held the foot of his own shadow. She noticed with a shock that it wasn't attached at all. Wendy rubbed her eyes, then pinched herself once on the arm. When it didn't have any effect, she had to concede she was not dreaming. Giving in to her curiosity, she asked,
"Boy, why are you crying?"
The boy was on his feet in an instant, bowing extravagantly. Ignoring her question, he introduced himself. It was Peter Pan. She was elated. Someone she had told so many stories about was in her bedroom, and she was having small talk with him. She was so curious. Where did he live? What was his daily life like? Who was his mother? He told her he did not have a mother. He lived in Neverland with the Lost Boys, a group of children without parents like himself. Wendy suddenly felt very sorry for the boy.
"No wonder you were crying," she said.
Peter threw back his head and laughed at this.
"I wasn't crying about mothers. I was crying because I couldn't get my shadow to stick, and I wasn't crying."
Wendy stifled a laugh of her own when she realized he had been trying to stick it on with soap. How like a boy. She knew a better way.
"It must be sewn on."
Wendy fetched her sewing kit from the bedside table and took out a sturdy piece of thread and a needle.
"This will hurt a little," she warned.
He nodded, insisting that he wouldn't cry. And she pierced the ankle of his shadow with the needle before turning it on his foot. Wendy had never sewn a shadow back on a person before, but she found it surprisingly easy. She sewed around the edges of Peter's feet, making sure the thread held firm. Finally, she snapped off the string and tied a little knot so it would not come off. Throughout the whole ordeal, Peter had his teeth firmly clenched, obviously determined not to show any sign of pain. The second the shadow was secure, he leapt to his feet. He twirled gleefully in the center of the nursery, watching his shadow do the same.
"Oh, the cleverness of me!" he exclaimed.
"Of course, I did nothing,"
Wendy said sarcastically.
"You did a little."
Wendy could not tell if Peter was joking.
"Well, if I'm so little help, I should just go back to sleep."
Wendy jumped back into her bed and pulled the covers up over her head. She waited, hoping this would make him feel guilty about not thanking her. For a dreadful moment, she thought the intriguing boy had called her bluff and flown back out the way he came. Then she felt a tapping on her foot. She lifted the blanket to see Peter sitting cross-legged in the air above her feet.
"Don't go, Wendy. One girl is more use than 20 boys."
She sat up and asked him if he really thought so. When he nodded, she almost blushed. She wasn't used to a boy her age who held girls in such high regard. Despite his arrogance, it was hard to stay mad at him for very long. She told him she would like to give him a kiss. Peter, in response, held out his hand.
"Don't you know what a kiss is?"
"I will once you give one to me," he said.
Wendy hesitated. She quickly plucked a thimble from her dresser and deposited it in Peter's hand. He grinned in astonishment and set it on the tip of his ring finger. He said he would like to give her a kiss in return. Wendy foolishly inclined her head slightly towards his, expecting a proper kiss, only to receive an acorn button on a string. She accepted it politely and hung it around her neck. Peter glanced left and right, suddenly distracted. He roamed the room, glancing from corner to corner, until alighting on one of the dressers he'd searched through earlier. He pressed his ear up against it, then grinned and pulled the drawer open. The spark Wendy had glimpsed earlier flew out, zipping around Peter's head and making a light tinkling sound. Now that Wendy's eyes had adjusted to the tiny creature's light, she could easily tell it was a fairy. Peter introduced her as Tinkerbell. She was called that since she mends the pots and kettles for fairy society. She was a rather rude fairy, and some of the things she said to Wendy, Peter refused to translate. He demanded she apologize, and the fairy darted away to a far corner of the room. Flattered that he would stick up for her like this, Wendy was already regretting her earlier cowardice.
"Peter,"
she said,
"I would like to give you a thimble."
Peter was delighted to be receiving so many gifts at once. Before she could hesitate, she kissed him on the lips quickly. He blinked, digesting what had just happened. Suddenly, Wendy felt a sharp tugging on her hair. It was Tinkerbell, jingling angrily at her. Peter translated,
"I'll yank your hair out if you ever give Peter a thimble again."
He didn't understand why. Wendy understood perfectly. Peter finally told Wendy why he had come. He wanted to hear the end of Cinderella, a story she had told many times before bed. Peter had always missed the end and desperately wanted to know, did the prince find the mysterious woman who left the glass slipper behind? Wendy told him she had, and that the two of them lived happily ever after. Peter grinned and did a backflip in midair hearing this, and began rocketing toward the window. She managed to stop him just before he left, demanding to know where he was going. He was off to Neverland to tell the boys, of course.
"I have lots of stories."
Peter's reaction to the simple ending of Cinderella had thrilled Wendy, and the idea of having a whole audience of such boys was extremely tempting. Taking to the idea at once, he grabbed her hand and pulled her toward the window.
"Wait, Peter, I don't know how to fly, and I cannot leave my mother and brothers behind."
Her common sense had taken over her enthusiasm. But Peter was very clever. He began by telling her of all the wonders of Neverland. What won Wendy over was when Peter told her of the mermaids that lived in the waters. She had always wanted to meet a mermaid, ever since she first heard of them in stories. Wendy awakened Michael and John and introduced them to the strange boy in their room. They both recognized him at once. Wendy's description in her stories had been completely accurate. As he was taught long ago, Peter dusted the children with the indignant Tinkerbell's fairy dust and told them to think happy thoughts. Soon, the children were flying through the room in circles like the mobile over little Michael's bed. Michael and John were easy to convince. All Peter had to do was tell them of the pirates and Indians that inhabited Neverland and were his continual adversaries.
"We must go at once!"
exclaimed John, who had adopted a fencing stance in midair, practicing for some upcoming sword fight.
"Away we go!"
Peter crowed and shot out the window with the speed of an arrow. Wendy followed afterward, then Michael and John. The shock of the winter air was sharp, but it was soon eclipsed by sheer exhilaration. The window was left open, curtains fluttering in the breeze. When Mr. and Mrs. Darling entered to check on their children, they found only an empty room. The children had vanished, seemingly into thin air. We'll fly off to Neverland after the break. And now, back to the story. John flew just behind Peter and Wendy, clutching the top hat to his head. He had grabbed the hat at the last minute, believing no true gentleman could leave home without one. John raced Michael past Buckingham Palace, giving his younger brother a head start. They were completely lost in the joy of flying, circling spires, diving close to the River Thames, and zipping in and out of clouds. They were so thrilled with their newfound prowess that they didn't even notice the passage of time. The first time John thought of it was when he heard a yawn from behind him. Michael appeared to be falling asleep mid-flight. A second later, his eyes drooped shut and he plummeted toward the ground.
"Peter, save him!" cried Wendy.
Neither she nor John were strong enough flyers to catch the falling boy. Peter watched with amusement, laughing, as the boy continued his fall. After a few perilous moments, Peter dove and caught Michael just in time. This happened many times throughout their flight over London.
"There he goes again,"
Peter exclaimed with glee. John turned and saw Michael dropping once again. Peter seemed to relish that he was the only one who could save Michael from certain death. Whenever they complained of being hungry, Peter would seek out a flock of birds carrying human food and snatch it from their beaks. The birds squawked in protest, but Peter was practiced at evading them and always returned unscathed. Eventually, they found themselves flying over a vast expanse of water. Which ocean this was, John could not tell. He found himself wary of Peter as a guide. When he flew up beside him to ask where they were going, Peter's brow knit in confusion, as if they had never met before. Even Wendy had to tell him her name multiple times.
"How should we find our way back if he forgets us?"
John thought to himself. After conferring with Wendy, they decided they should not let the forgetful boy out of their sight. Suddenly, Peter exclaimed,
"There it is!"
He did not need to specify what it was. Neverland approached on the horizon, an island whose landscape was intimately familiar to all of them. It was like a quilt stitched together from all their childhood fantasies. John noticed the lagoon almost immediately, just as he had pictured it. But Peter slowed down as he approached, and the Darling children did the same to match his pace. It was getting dark fast, and the island was quickly becoming more difficult to discern. John didn't want to tell Wendy, but he was still scared of the dark. This fear was slightly alleviated when Tinkerbell flew to their side, casting her light on all four children. Tinkerbell flew up by Peter's ear and whispered something into it. His expression instantly took on a grave appearance. The pirates had sighted them and were readying Long Tom, their cannon, to fire upon the children. John panicked and told Peter to get Tinkerbell away from them. The fairy's light was making them an easy target in the darkness. The stubborn fairy refused to move. After much persuading, Tinkerbell agreed to hide under John's hat. He removed it and quickly stored the fairy inside, passing the hat off to Wendy as he did so. He didn't like the idea of holding a girl, even one as tiny as Tinkerbell. Something massive and heavy ripped through the air above them. A powerful gust of wind threw John head over heels in a random direction. When he righted himself, he could make out Michael doing the same, but had completely lost sight of Wendy and Peter. Grasping each other in fear, the two of them descended to the jungle below, narrowly avoiding another cannonball. John nearly collapsed from relief when his feet touched the forest floor. Michael looked exhausted, and John had to shake his brother to keep him from falling asleep again. The leaves rustled in front of them. John ducked behind a large mushroom and pulled his brother down beside him. A nasty band of pirates emerged from the woods in front of them, carrying torches to light their way. John and Michael exchanged a glance. Without much thought, they could name nearly every member of this band from Wendy's stories. Bill Jukes, every inch of him tattooed. Noodler, who had his hands fixed on backwards. Gentleman Starkey, who was once an usher in a public school. When the band was in full view, John's breath caught in his throat. In the midst of this band of cutthroats was an elegant man in a chariot pulled by his crew. A curved iron hook sat on his wrist in place of a right hand. This was Captain James Hook. John had to place a hand over Michael's mouth to stop him from crying out in alarm. These were the pirates Peter fought? Suddenly, John was not so sure he wanted to be a swashbuckler anymore. Hook stopped for a moment, cigar smoke circling his face like a wreath. He exchanged a few words with his bosun Smee, a rosy-cheeked Irishman who seemed utterly out of place in this ruthless band. Then the moment passed, and the band moved on. After the pirates vanished into the trees, John and Michael remained rooted to the spot, terrified. A crocodile emerged from the foliage, following the pirates' tracks. A strange, hollow ticking came from within its belly. The enormous creature paid them no mind as it lumbered past, vanishing from sight as quickly as the pirates. A long while passed, and then another band emerged following the same trail, and with them, John noted, a familiar golden light. The two Darling boys gathered that these were the Lost Boys Peter had spoken of. John could not quite understand the conversation, since he was only hearing half of it, but he gathered Tinkerbell was relaying orders to them from Peter. Peter wanted them to shoot down a rare bird that was coming to land on the island. They must be sure to kill the dangerous thing. John watched, intrigued. Hunting was a sport enjoyed by adults, and he had never seen children allowed to participate. Maybe once he introduced himself, he'd be allowed to join in. Dawn was breaking over the horizon.
Do days move this quickly in Neverland?
John thought to himself.
Or have we just lost track of time again?
He watched as the Lost Boys readied their bows. They knocked their arrows and pointed in the direction Tinkerbell had indicated. John followed their line of sight through a gap in the trees, where he saw Wendy floating above the horizon, gliding toward the island.
That isn't a bird,
he thought to himself. Then his eyes widened when he realized what was about to happen. Before he could do anything, the Lost Boys let fly, and a hail of arrows sailed into the sky. In the distance, Wendy went limp and dropped out of sight below the tree line. These feral boys had killed his sister. We'll return to the darker side of Neverland in a few moments. And now back to the story. Wendy awoke with a gasp. Her head was heavy, and she could feel a bruise forming by her collarbone. Ouch! She'd hit the ground, hard, but she'd survived falling out of the sky. She looked down. Peter's acorn button, his kiss, was split nearly in two by a large arrowhead, which had not quite pierced the button. He had saved her life. But from whom? And were the shooters still after her? She sat up and looked around her. She appeared to be in a small cabin, constructed of branches and leaves. It had a door and a chimney, but no windows. Otherwise, it was a surprisingly lovely residence. Hearing the knock, she rose to her feet, crossed the small room to the door, and slowly opened it. A group of six feral boys stood at the doorstep, hats in their hands. They introduced themselves as Slightly, Toodles, Nibs, Curly, and the twins. John and Michael stood with them, but they needed no introduction.
Where am I?
Wendy asked.
Wendy, lady,
Slightly said rapidly.
For you, we have built this house.
Wendy was flattered. She had never had a whole house built for her, by boys she barely knew, no less. She was even more astonished when they got down on their knees and begged for her to be their mother.
Do you think I ought to? I haven't much experience. I'm only a little girl,
Wendy stammered. And then Peter emerged dramatically from a nearby tree. Of course she ought to. He explained they didn't need a mother with experience. They simply needed someone to be motherly to them. He told her that Tinkerbell had wanted her dead, so he had exiled her. Wendy had a hard time digesting this. She knew the fairy was jealous, but she didn't expect her to attempt murder. Peter waved this away as if it was just fun and games. Wendy stared warily at the spot in the woods Peter emerged from. If she strained her eyes, she could just make out the flicker of the treacherous fairy among the leaves, an angry fairy.
"It was Tootle's arrow that struck you," Peter explained proudly, "and I would have killed him on the spot if you had not survived."
There was nothing malicious about the way he said it. He sounded like a boy bragging to his mother about doing his chores. Wendy took to the role of mother extremely well. She set a curfew, made sure all the boys were tucked into bed, and told them stories every night. She also introduced them to the concept of medicine by giving them each a cup of spring water that she told them would taste awful but was good for them. Tinkerbell was exiled by Peter for her attempt on Wendy's life, but he could not stay mad at her, and soon she was living in the Lost Boys' hideout with Peter and the others. When he referred to Wendy as their mother and himself as their father, a little tinkle came from her corner, like the fairy was muttering in disapproval. Wendy was never entirely comfortable living under the same roof as this jealous fairy. It took quite some time for Wendy to get used to the ways of Peter Pan. He was so intent on having fun that he often confused make-believe and reality. The Lost Boys dreaded those meals when Peter would simply pretend to eat while leaving the food to get cold. Since he was their leader, they were obliged to do the same and went to bed hungry. John and Michael asked Peter about the strange ticking crocodile they had seen. Peter leapt up in excitement and began to tell his favorite story, how he cut off Hook's right hand and fed it to a crocodile. The beast has been following the pirate ever since, intent on finishing the meal. The only reason Hook had lived this long, Peter claimed, is that the crocodile swallowed a clock. The ticking always alerts him before the beast is close enough to strike. But one day the clock will run down and Hook will be doomed. If Peter doesn't get to him first, of course. John and Michael burst into applause, followed by the rest of the Lost Boys. Since their arrival, they hadn't talked about their parents at all. The Lost Boys were their family, Wendy and Peter, the only parents they needed. Once Wendy had gently tried to ask Michael about their parents while he was building a kite, but all she got was a blank stare. As he promised, Peter took Wendy to meet the mermaids. They were not nearly as pleasant as she expected them to be. While beautiful from afar, an up-close look revealed sharp scales and suspicious eyes. When they first saw Wendy, they dove underwater, splashing both her and Peter as they went. Wendy was nearly heartbroken that creatures she loved in her stories seemed to despise her so instinctively. As they stared at the still rippling water, they heard coarse voices, pirate voices. Wendy looked up to see a rowboat approaching with three figures in it. She and Peter dove into the water, leaving only the very tops of their heads above the surface. In the boat were two pirates. Peter identified them as Smee and Starkey, and a woman bound between them. Peter said that was Tiger Lily, the daughter of the chief, a proud member of the Piccaninny tribe. As they watched, the cutthroats deposited the woman on a rock in the middle of the lagoon.
"It's called Maroon Rock," Peter explained in a hushed voice, "because the pirates leave victims on here to drown as the tide rises."
He instructed her to wait in the water and vanished beneath the surface before she could protest. A dreadful few moments passed as the pirates chained Tiger Lily to the rock and got back in their boat. Suddenly, a dreadful voice echoed over the water.
"Ahoy there, you lubbers!"
"Aye, Captain?"
It was Smee who spoke first.
"Set the girl free,"
the voice continued. Then Wendy realized what was happening. Peter was imitating his arch nemesis to save Tiger Lily. How clever of him.
But, Captain...
Smee began to protest.
At once, do you hear? Or I'll plunge my hook into you.
Panicking, Smee and Starkey undid Tiger Lily's restraints and let her into the water. She swam away as fast as she could. Wendy giggled and hoped Peter wouldn't betray the game by crowing in triumph. Then she heard a distant splash and the words,
"Boat ahoy!"
in the same voice Peter had been using. Another rowboat was approaching, with only one occupant. Hook was more dreadful than Wendy could have imagined. He rowed with both arms, his glistening iron hook scraping horribly against the wooden oar as he went. When he reached his companion's boat, he stood and stepped into it, sitting beside them.
"Captain, is all well?" Smee asked.
He seemed perturbed by Hook's silence. Hook stood and took a step onto the rock, gazing out at the black water.
"The game's up,"
the captain said hoarsely.
"Those boys have found a mother."
"Oh, evil day," cried Starkey.
"What's a mother?" asked Smee.
Wendy felt her heart swell with pride that her mere presence could cause such a reaction in this evil man. At the same time, she felt a little sorry for Smee's ignorance. Hook pointed away from the rock to where a nest drifted in the tide. In it sat the Neverbird, a magnificent songbird native to the island.
"That is a mother," Hook proclaimed.
"The nest fell into the water, but the bird does not desert its children. Do you understand?"
Smee nodded, though he clearly did not.
"Captain," he said hesitantly, "perhaps we kidnap these boys' new mother and make her our mother."
Wendy had to stop herself from crying out in defiance of it. The three pirates shook on the plan, and then Hook stopped. He looked down to his feet, planted on the slippery rock.
"Where is the princess?"
They told him that they let her go under his orders. Wendy could not see Hook's expression, but when he spoke again, his voice had acquired a dangerous edge.
"I gave no such order. Brimstone and Gall, what are you men doing up there?"
Hook's voice thundered over the water. No, Peter's. He was doing his impression again.
"Stupid boy," thought Wendy.
She risked a glance back to the rock. Hook's eyes were as wide as dinner plates.
"Who are you, stranger?" "I am James Hook, captain of the Jolly Roger."
Hook looked about furiously, trying to ascertain the origin of the voice.
"No, you are not. If you are Hook, then who am I?" "You are a codfish, only a codfish."
Hook blanched at being called a codfish by his own voice. For a moment, he seemed to have no idea what to do, before regaining his composure and turning back to his fellow pirates. Both Smee and Starkey were standing frozen in place, shivering in their boots. Hook raised his left hand to smack some sense back into them when Peter Pan's actual voice carried across the lagoon.
"Are you ready, boys?"
On hearing their foe, both Smee and Starkey came to their senses and drew their swords. Starkey jumped into one boat and Smee the other. Hook remained on the rock, black eyes searching the water for Pan. John and Slightly burst from the water, pushing Starkey out of the boat and rowing it away. Toodles and the twins jumped on Smee's boat from behind, parrying slashes from the bosun. Seeing the water stir, Hook leapt into the water, claw outstretched. He landed with a splash right beside Wendy. Their eyes met for a moment, and at this buccaneer's dreadful stare, she fainted. Peter cut through the water as smoothly as when he was flying. The skirmish was going well,
Both Starkey and Smee were in full retreat, rowing back toward the distant shape of the Jolly Roger in their remaining boat. The Lost Boys hurled taunts at them from the other boat. Both pirates had inflicted a fair share of wounds, but there had been no casualties yet. He noticed Wendy floating on her back by Maroon Rock. Hook clung to the slippery rock, reaching for her. The thought of Hook touching even a hair on Wendy's head filled Peter with a violent fury. Peter burst from the water and slipped a dagger from his opponent's belt before the pirate could notice. He lunged. Hook was fast for an adult and caught Peter's hand by the wrist. He then brought his hook down on Peter's head, knocking him flat on the rock and cutting a red gash across his hairline. Peter lay there, coughing. Hook knelt beside him. Hook raised to deliver a killing blow. Hook froze. Near unconsciousness, Peter saw something that delighted him. A figure of deep green was cutting its way through the dark water, making its way toward Maroon Rock. The crocodile had caught up with Hook. When he looked back up, his foe was gone, swimming furiously away from the pursuing crocodile. Peter closed his eyes and sighed in relief, and then something brushed his hand. It was Wendy's drifting, unconscious hand. A mermaid had grabbed a hold of her feet and was dragging her underwater. It wanted to drown her. He grabbed Wendy's arms and with a few mighty tugs got her out of the mermaid's clutches and onto the square foot of rock beside him. He looked around. The Lost Boys were nowhere in sight, having rowed off in pursuit of the fleeing pirates. The only evidence of the fight were some red spots in the water and Starkey's enormous hat floating around the rock in lazy circles. He knocked her on the head.
The rock is almost underwater, Wendy. We should go.
She spluttered and sat up beside him.
Yes,
she replied faintly.
Shall we swim or fly, Peter?
He told her he was too tired and injured to do either.
Could you swim or fly to the shore without my help?
She shook her head. He moaned in defeat.
Do you mean we'll both be drowned?
She asked. Peter had no reply. His vision was starting to fade. He shook his head to stay conscious a little longer, and then a string tapped the side of his head.
Look, Peter!
Though still tired, Wendy's voice was hopeful again.
It's Michael's kite!
It was. The poor kite fluttered overhead as if to say, "Can I help?" Peter encouraged Wendy to get on it, since she was a lady and he couldn't leave her to drown. At first she refused, but he wrapped the tail around her and pushed her away, letting it carry her back toward the shore. Peter sat there for a minute as the rock continued to shrink around him. He hadn't been scared at all during the fight, even when Hook was moments away from gouging his throat out. But now, well... But then a strange grin spread across his face. He thought to himself,
to die would be an awfully big adventure.
All he could do was rise unsteadily to his feet and await the tide, listening to the mermaids singing their chilling songs to the moon. While Peter Pan's stories are made to seem like lighthearted adventures, there is a dark side to them that is often overlooked. The way Peter immediately appoints Wendy to be the mother to his family underlines a certain absence in his life, one that's referenced in every tale that features him. In a borderline Freudian way, Peter has a longing for a mother figure to replace the mother he left behind in The Little White Bird. This interpretation is complicated by Wendy's adolescent crush on the boy, which simultaneously brings them closer together and drives them farther apart. Thank you for listening to Tales.
Next week, we'll finish the story of Peter Pan. Join us in 2 weeks to hear the downfall of Captain Hook and the strangely bittersweet end to this tale of adventure. If you want to listen to more episodes of Tales or other Parcast podcasts, you can find all of Parcast's podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory. Some listeners have been asking how to help the show. Well, if you enjoy the show, the best way to do that is to leave a 5-star review. Join me in 2 weeks for another dark and surprising fairy tale. Tales was created by Max Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Tales is written by Robert Teamstra. I'm Vanessa Richardson.